You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Latinos are the largest and fastest growing minority group in the United States, but they've been shaping the country for centuries. Ray Suarez, a senior correspondent for PBS NewsHour and co-anchor of the PRI show America Abroad, chronicles this long and varied history in his latest book, Latino Americans, The 500-Year Legacy That Shaped a Nation. It's published by Salibra, and it is a companion book to the PBS documentary series of the same name. I'm very pleased it has brought Ray Suarez back to our show.
It's great to be home, and it's great to be in your booth.
The term Latinos covers a wide variety of people from many different countries of origin. Is there anything that unites them other than the Spanish language? And even there, the Spanish language is so different if you're talking to an Argentinian, a Mexican, or somebody from Spain.
And a lot of people who identify as Latinos either don't speak the language or don't speak it well or don't speak it primarily. So as we move forward in this thing that we're living our way into of a majority-minority country, even Spanish will become less essential to that identity than it is today. There's sort of a shared history of a heritage in countries that were part of the Spanish Empire of mostly Christianity. At one point, you could have said Catholicism almost entirely, but at mostly Christianity, and a sort of shared history in this country, which I think a lot of people don't really recognize. They're focused on the where you're from part and not the now that you're here part. When a Puerto Rican hangs out with a Mexican in Chicago, and there are two very large communities in that city, they don't make that much of a big thing about the difference. They're both Latinos and they're both comfortable and they both look at each other out of the corner of their eyes and recognize a cousin, a primo, in a world where the rest of the world is sort of Anglo or black or white ethnic or whatever it is, and they don't make too much of a big deal about the differences that might be between Puerto Ricans and Mexicans.
But would a Peruvian and a Cuban feel the same way?
Increasingly. I think it's a generational thing. If you talk to people from my parents' generation, it's a bigger deal. And if you talk to people from my children's generation, it's no big deal at all. And when I look at, for instance, my daughter's team from her high school, she is on a rowing team, which blows my mind anyway that she's on a rowing team.
Yeah, it's a very kind of Latino sport.
Well, exactly. But it's a Salvadoran, a Cuban, a Spaniard, her little Jew-Rican self, and a Chinese kid. And they get a big kick out of the fact that they're all Latinas of some sort and don't really make much difference about the national origin.
The 2010 census showed that there are 40 million residents born outside the United States. Over half, 21 million, come from Latin American and Caribbean countries. That's a notable shift from just a decade ago, isn't it?
It really started to zoom during the 70s, and then we hit the accelerator again during the 90s, in part because the economy, if we remember back that long, was going great guns and creating a lot of jobs and creating a lot of new opportunities in the service industry and a lot of labor shortages in certain kinds of jobs. And people don't come when there's no jobs. We forget that. They only come here through a very efficient Bush telegraph. And if you get up in Durango and say, I'm going north now, you have a specific place to go and a specific job to do.
And immigration has slowed down because there are fewer jobs available in this country. Also, there's been a certain amount of reverse immigration, hasn't
Absolutely.
There?
We're at net zero now from Mexico, and Mexico is the largest single contributor both to the Latino population in the United States and to the number of people living illegally in the country and working illegally in the country. So when the economy suffered here, Mexicans, they're not crazy. They're not going to do something that doesn't make any economic sense. They stopped coming, and they started going home.
There was a lot of talk after the election about why Mitt Romney lost, and members of his party admitted that they weren't able to capture the Latino vote. Is it simply a matter of the Republican position on immigration?
That and a lot of other things. I mean, implicit in what a lot of Republicans have said in unguarded moments in the last 10 years has been this notion that Latinos are intense users of public services, that they're moochers, that they're freeloaders, that they come here for the benefits. But academic studies that come out of reputable universities and real-life scholars show that Latinos are actually less intensive users of public services, in part because many of them are very cautious about using them, about entering the system, about telling people where you live, about telling people all your intimate details. And a lot of the people who are in the country without papers don't qualify for disability, workman's comp, unemployment, Social Security, all of that. This idea that they're moochers when they are the most highly workplace-affiliated population of all is it's kind of a kick in the teeth for people who are working so hard.
And there are a lot of people who wonder why, since so many Latinos are also cultural conservatives and have given American politics, people like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, why they haven't allied themselves more with the Republican Party. Same-sex marriage, abortion rights, et cetera. These are all issues that Latinos seem to take different positions on than other people who vote for Democrats.
I think you'll see a severe generational split in that. So the 5,000 Latinos a week who turn 18 definitely don't feel that way. That old idea, well, they're cultural conservatives, they're just not with us yet, that's going to go away in the next 20 years, and that will make the climb even tougher for the Republican Party. But let me...
Is that going to happen in the Cuban community as well?
Look, there's a political split between Cubans who were born here and Cubans who were born in Cuba. And the generations growing up in Miami now in a polyglot, cosmopolitan, pan-Latin city are not all wound up with the Castro brothers and how nefarious they are. They live their lives and they're worried about what traffic is like on 95 much more than they're worried about brothers to the rescue.
My guest is Ray Suarez, in case you don't recognize that voice. His latest book is Latino Americans, the 500-year legacy that shaped a nation. Let's go back 500 years, although there might be a new focus on Latinos. They've been in what is now the United States for a very long time. The first Spanish settlers arrived before the arrival of the Mayflower, before the Jamestown colony in Virginia was set up. Were they here before anybody from Europe?
In numbers, the first sizable European-descended population in what is now the United States comes from Spain. The first European language spoken in what is now the United States was Spanish.
And that was mostly in Florida.
Florida and New Mexico, starting in the final years of the 16th century.
Now, how long did St. Augustine remain primarily a Spanish city?
For most of the time between its founding and the arrival of the United States, once Florida becomes fully possessed by the United States, it was a Spanish-speaking city, not always under the flag of Spain. So with wars and the vagaries of imperial wars in Europe, it changed hands a couple of times. But for most of three centuries, from the 16th to the 19th century, it was a Spanish city.
Kind of similar to what happened with New Orleans and French.
And yeah, exactly.
Well, you mentioned the Southwest for a fair part of our history. The Southwest was part of Mexico.
Yeah, all the way up until the war between the United States and Mexico when the country changed hands. And, you know, part of 23 U.S. states were once part of either the Spanish Empire, Mexico, or both. And we should wrap our heads around that a little bit. You know, when you're sitting on the I-5 and there's traffic between San Diego and Los Angeles, you know, there's traffic between St. James and Our Lady of the Angels. And we ought to, you know, embrace that a little bit, I think. We ought to remember that North America was the object of desire for multiple empires. It isn't just this austere English thing that starts in the upper right-hand corner of the picture and moves west.
Well, California, practically every city has a Spanish origin. When people like Juan de Anate moved north, were they looking to save souls or to find gold?
Well, both. And that's the interesting thing about Spain's possession of the southwest quadrant of the country for all those years. When a column would go out, it included a small number of settlers, people who were living in a place like Zacatecas or Mexico City, who would say, all right, let's take a chance in this place. We'll have our own farm. We'll have our own land. There were soldiers and priests, and they would head out as part of a unified Spanish project. They would build a chapel. They would set out squares of farmable land and build a fort. The presidio was the military installation, the mission, the religious installation, and they would build a school in the same place and try to teach the natives Catholicism, bring them into a farming settlement, and run a unified military religious colony in a place. And that's what Santa Fe, New Mexico is.
There was resistance at times, especially from the Hopi and other Indians. In Acoma, there was a particularly horrible thing that happened.
I've
been
terrible.
To Acoma. It is still a depressed place where people get their water from rain that just leaves puddles that has insects in it. But they take it, they try to clean it, and that's what they drink from.
Acoma is a very depressed place and a stunningly beautiful place at the same time. But it's also a reminder of the horrors of the early encounter between the Spanish and the Pueblo Indians. Juan de Oñate, the governor of Santa Fe, his nephew is out there, and they arrive at Acoma, a column of soldiers, and they say, you know, basically, give us food and water. And the Indians say no, and they attack the Pueblo, and in a particularly cruel gesture, end up chopping the feet off of a dozen men. And this starts a war that lasts for decades and finally culminates in the only successful native uprising against European settlers in North American history. The Spaniards were kicked out of New Mexico for decades.
And interestingly, a statue that was dedicated to Oñate was desecrated by Native Americans who are still angry at what happened 300 years ago.
A useful reminder that not every piece of history is celebrated equally by everyone. When Juan de Oñate's statue was dedicated to mark the 400th founding of the colony that became the state of New Mexico, natives chopped the foot off the statue. They never returned.
Were there rules for how the colonists were supposed to treat the Indians? Did Oñate break those rules?
Yes. And, you know, you have to remember how far away Santa Fe is from New Mexico, even today. And yes, you can get on a plane in Albuquerque and be in Mexico City in a few hours. But then it might as well have been on the other side of the world. So a viceroy, the viceroy of New Spain, might have edicts issuing from his office on pieces of paper. But in the rough and tumble of the edge of two worlds where colonists met Indians, it could get pretty rough, and it did. And they were very cruel, and they violated the laws, and eventually Oñate is punished and exiled for that.
But the Pueblo Indian revolt, which was a success, was only a success for a short time.
And, you know, it's in part because this is what happens in colonies all over the world. A portion of the Pueblo people had begun to speak Spanish, had converted to Catholicism, had intermarried with soldiers and settlers, so had become Hispanicized to a degree. And when there started to be real trouble in the Pueblo Confederacy, some said, let's bring back the Spanish. It's a way of keeping us from going to war with each other. And that's what they did.
Ray Suarez's latest book is Latino Americans, the 500-Year Legacy That Shaped a Nation. It's published by Salibra. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Ray Suarez, who's a senior correspondent for PBS NewsHour and host of the public radio show, or co-host with Deb Amos.
With Deb Amos and Melissa Brand.
of the show called America Abroad. He used to be the host of Talk of the Nation on NPR, and he's the author of a number of books. The most recent is Latino Americans, the 500-year legacy that shaped a nation. It is published by Celebra, and it is a companion book to a PBS documentary series, which will be aired
September 17th. Three Tuesday nights, 2 hours a shot. So it's a six-hour, six-chapter, you might say, history of Latinos in America, starting on September 17th on PBS.
We've been talking about the Spanish invasion doing rather well, if you consider beating Pueblo Indians and taking over other parts of the country. When did things start reversing? When did they start going the other direction?
The Spanish Empire began to decay, and some historians say really they were victims of their own success by finding some of the largest gold and silver deposits on planet Earth. They entered a phase where they didn't have to work hard or work smart for their money and created a globe-straddling empire, but you might argue didn't do as much with it as the British did.
But that was mostly in South America, although there is gold in California, which Spain controlled for a while. They didn't find it.
They didn't find it. It was found in the Mexican period, and the Mexican period didn't last too long. Fremont et al., and the 49ers and statehood were just around the corner.
And manifest destiny. That led to the push west, and the Mexicans who were there obviously were the ones who had to be displaced.
You know, you hear a lot even to this day when you travel in certain communities in Texas, in Colorado, in Arizona. We didn't cross the border. The border crossed us. And you have to remember that these places had been Spanish for centuries and suddenly, with the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, became American. But that treaty is not known to most Americans. It guarantees language rights, cultural rights, guarantees the land rights of Spanish grantees of land, and it doesn't last long.
There are laws now in many of those places that state English is the only language that can be taught in the schools.
Official language laws, a general hostility toward telling, let's say, a whole fleshed out history of that part of the world.
Well, I remember being taught almost tangentially that the Mexican American War was one of the worst wars the United States ever engaged in, one of the most unfair wars. But it's not something that we discuss very much. We like to believe that until Vietnam, we were always on the right side.
It was a nasty little war, ginned up, fought on false pretenses. Ulysses Grant, Abraham Lincoln, a lot of mid-19th century Americans thought that it was not a war that that we should be very proud of. And it resulted, though, in some of the richest and fastest growing parts of the country today becoming the United States.
What about the anti-colonial uprisings in Puerto Rico and Cuba in the 19th century? Did we see our role in all of that as part of the Monroe Doctrine?
Yeah. You know, one of the coolest parts of writing this book, Leonard, I got to tell you how much fun it was for me to either re-remember, sort of after having known this but hidden it somewhere in some synapse, or learn for the first time about the relationship between the United States and the Caribbean in the 19th century. Several times in the 19th century, the United States asks the court in Spain, in Madrid, can we buy Cuba from you? There were southern agricultural interests that would have made it into basically a huge tropical plantation, which it was already, but running along American lines.
Another slave state.
Another slave state, certainly. And no less than James C. Calhoun says, you are doing something perilous if you buy this island, which is majority black, speaks another language, has been under the heel of a foreign country for centuries, and would challenge the racial norms of the United States at the time, because also obviously, a large mixed race population inhabits this world of the Caribbean as well. That's the Spanish turn us down both times. There's a revolution in Cuba, called in Cuba the 10 Years' War, which lasts roughly from the end of the American Civil War to the middle of the 1870s. José Martí is exiled and becomes the father of the next Cuban revolution while in exile, and a great hero to Cubans on all sides of the ideological divides today. And writing this book and reading his memoirs and his journalism in Spanish and in English was just a great experience for me. You know, some of writing is drudgery.
He spent a lot of time in the United States,
11 years, and it was a formative experience for him. He wrote the still seminal essay, Our America, while living in the United States. He was a correspondent for newspapers all over the Spanish-speaking world, covered the trial of the assassin of James Garfield, covered the opening of the Brooklyn Bridge, wrote stunning prose about a day out in Coney Island. He was a keen observer of American life.
Well, there was a racial divide in the Caribbean as well. If you look at Haiti and the Dominican Republic, one seeing itself as kind of white and Hispanic, the other black and French speaking, and a lot of tension between the two. In Cuba, blacks have always been treated as an underclass. How is that any different than what was going on in the United States?
If you ask Latinos, certainly Caribbeans, their first take on it in polite conversation will be to say that the problems of the United States, the kind of binary notions of race, you're either white or black, the terrible history of race in the United States is not something that Caribbeans and certainly other Latin Americans would recognize.
Even though there was slavery in all of those countries.
And slavery that lasted longer than it lasted in the United States. Slavery isn't ended in the Spanish colonies until the middle of the 1870s. But if you talk to them longer, and if they're willing to be honest, they'll talk about a high degree of color consciousness in these countries. But it's not as absolute. And it's more gradient than binary. Does that make it better? No. But it makes it different. And it offers the opportunity for people across these gradations to enjoy mobility that it wasn't possible for them to enjoy in the United States, where the one-drop rule in both in social custom and in law lasted well into the 20th century.
But if you look at the leaders of these countries, almost all of them have been the lightest skinned ones.
Or trying to hide a tinge of melanin from back in the family past and almost by trying to become more Catholic than the Pope by whitening their pseudo-history and whitening their coterie in such a way that that tries to remove that taint.
My guest is Ray Suarez. His latest book, Latino Americans, The 500-Year Legacy That Shaped a Nation, published by Celebra. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Puerto Rico became a U.S. territory, but not Cuba.
Yes, and part of that had to do with the unwillingness of the United States Senate to take Cuba on. And the only terms under which the United States could enter the war, McKinley gave the Congress reassurance that we would not try to absorb Cuba. And Puerto Rico, it wasn't like Puerto Rico was different. It just wasn't thought of. So the thinking about Puerto Rico only really started in earnest after the smoke cleared from the Spanish-American War and the American flag was flying over El Morro in San Juan Harbor. Then the what do we do about Puerto Rico question starts. But the Platt Amendment, passed in Congress, required that once Spain is ejected from Cuba, the United States would not seek to annex the island.
Although we did everything possible to take it over economically.
Everything short of annexation, you might say, but they did have their own legislature and their own president, such as it was.
You write about a woman named Isabel Gonzalez. She led the way for Puerto Ricans to move freely between the United States and Puerto Rico.
before there was Mark Anthony, before there was J-Lo, before there was Ray Suarez, there was, in a way, Puerto Rican number one. And Isabel González...
She known well in the Puerto Rican community?
No, it's not a well-known story.
Because it's the first time I've ever heard of her.
And I'm hoping that my brothers and sisters here in New York read this story and think hard on it. She comes to New York Harbor shortly after the United States wins Puerto Rico from Spain. And as is the custom, she was on a boat called the Philadelphia. It comes into New York Harbor. It's loaded with agricultural products. So two men come onto the deck, a customs agent and an immigration agent. So people from other countries, since these boats go through the Caribbean to different possessions and countries, they check everybody's papers. And Isabel González, coming from San Juan, expects to just walk ashore because, after all, she comes from a place where the stars and stripes fly. And they say, no, no, you have to go to Ellis Island, ma'am. You can't just walk ashore. You're an immigrant. And basically she says, no, I'm not an immigrant because I come from Puerto Rico, which is now possessed by the United States. And the case goes all the way to the Supreme Court. And she eventually prevails in front of the highest court. By then, the case is moot because she's married her legally resident Puerto Rican fiancé who was waiting for her in Staten Island. But she was so passionate about it that she fought it all the way to the high court, even though her own personal case had been settled. And it creates in law the right of Puerto Ricans to move to the mainland as Americans.
And when did that happen en masse? I imagine the Depression made it less attractive.
There was a Puerto Rican community after the First World War, one of some considerable size.
And mostly in New York?
Mostly in New York, almost entirely.
And not Florida.
And not Florida. And that community starts to grow in the 20s, and there are fraternal organizations, Catholic Church-based organizations, hometown-based organizations, similar to other immigrants with the Landsmannschaften and the town societies of Italian neighborhoods. And then in the 30s, it really starts to take off. Things are terrible on the island, both natural calamities in the forms of particularly destructive storms and economic calamity in the economic decline of the agricultural interests that now own American interests, that now own a lot of Puerto Rican agriculture. Those twin disasters make Puerto Rico a terrible place to be in the 30s. So the flow really starts in earnest then and then kicks into high gear after the Second World War.
And Puerto Rico remains a troubled island.
Very high unemployment. Right now, terrible, terrible challenges that come from being a transshipment point for drugs, a transshipment point for illegal immigrants, very high crime rates in some of the urban areas. It's been a rough couple of years for Puerto Rico.
When we talk about Latinos in America, we usually talk about Mexicans, even though they are not exclusively from Central America coming to this country. But arrangements were made over the years to bring workers in. Why has that all fallen apart?
Because the United States has a very portable red carpet. So we roll it out very quickly when we need something, whether it's bracero agricultural workers from Mexico in the 40s.
Well, we still need those braceros. We just don't call them braceros anymore.
But when there's a time of economic unease in the United States, we suddenly rethink having foreigners here, not just Latinos, but people who come here to work from anywhere. We say, what are they doing here? We can't take care of our own people, which is a legitimate and understandable point. But, you know, people are not fungible in the way cash is or the way a used car is. They don't just disappear when you don't need them anymore the way you might like them to. So they have jobs and lives and children and homes and associations, and they don't just vaporize when you say, oh, unemployment's high, time to send them all back. The one time they did, which was a terrible miscarriage of justice, was in the 1930s in the Southwest, when basically the Immigration and Naturalization Service gave the high sign to state authorities across the Southwest and said, just do roundups, send them back. And hundreds of thousands of Mexicans and Mexican Americans were deported, many to a place they had never been.
And we see similar things happening today. The laws keep on changing. In the Southwest, do Latinos feel like they are the other racial group in the same way that African Americans might in the Northeast here?
Is
there stop and frisk?
There
in
is a unity
Texas
to the,
and Arizona
to the African American story, because it comes largely out of a shared experience of life in North America. And now that large numbers of people are coming from Africa voluntarily, that's changing in some big communities. But for the most part, the black experience is one of a high degree of understanding, common understanding of what it means to be black in America. In a place like Phoenix, you have people that arrived with the conquistadors and people that arrived the day before yesterday, literally, with a bindle and a rucksack. And they don't necessarily, when they look at each other, see themselves as the same thing. And we inside the community who are trying to measure this and wrap our arms around it and tell this story as reporters and sociologists, people who are trying to understand 21st century America, have to take a little bit more account of that. They may both be named Gomez, but you know, there's a big difference between a pediatrician named Gomez in the Phoenix's biggest hospital, and a guy who's bussing your table named Gomez, who literally crossed the border 2 weeks ago.
That applies to Suarez as well, I'm sure. Ray Suarez is a senior correspondent for PBS NewsHour and one of the hosts of the public radio show America Abroad, a PRI show. His latest book is Latino Americans, the 500-Year Legacy That Shaped a Nation. It is a companion to the PBS documentary series of the same name. The book is published by Celebra. And Ram Suarez, sorry we couldn't get to more of the story, but I guess that's why people will wind up watching
right.
The television show or reading
You've
a book.
Whetted their appetite.
We can only hope we have. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Great to be here. Thanks.